This is case number 75106. Good morning, Ms. Westbrook. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the court, I'm Deborah Westbrook on behalf of the Clark County Public Defender's Office and the appellant James Banks. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. After representing himself at trial, Mr. Banks was convicted of attempt murder and battery with a deadly weapon resulting in substantial bodily harm. He was then sentenced under the large habitual offender statute. Mr. Banks' convictions must be reversed because there were 7 major jury instruction errors that impacted both the attempt murder and the felony battery charges that were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, either alone or together, and they denied Mr. Banks a fair trial. But before I address the jury instruction errors, the simplest path to reversal is the fact that on this record and under existing Nevada law, Mr. Banks' waiver of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel was ineffective because he did not know that he faced habitual criminal treatment at the time that he made the waiver. Courts apply a high standard to determine whether a defendant has waived a constitutional right. Waivers of constitutional rights not only must be voluntary, but they must be knowing, intelligent acts done with the sufficient awareness of the relevant circumstances and the likely consequences.
Ms. Westbrook, may I inquire, is the Feretta issue stem from, because initially he wasn't charged with habitual criminal.
Correct.
So there was a Feretta canvas, and he was permitted to represent himself.
Correct.
Subsequently, when they added it, is your suggestion that the first was infirm because
Correct.
It didn't see that, or they should have re-canvassed him after, or both? I mean, you can have as many arguments as you want.
It's sort of a combination of both, and there are 2 key Nevada cases that govern the outcome of this appeal. Scott versus State, which came out in 1994, and then subsequently Hooks versus State, which came out in 2008. And Scott held that a defendant's pretrial waivers of counsel weren't knowing and intelligent when he was unaware of the potential for habitual criminal treatment at the time of the waivers.
What about, so why isn't, if we agree with you on that the second one was not valid, why isn't the remedy just to resentence the defendant? Why should we reverse the entire trial? Because arguably he understood what was going on the first Feretta canvas. Why not just a remedy of resentencing him for the underlying crimes?
Well, the problem is when you have a Feretta error, you have a defendant choosing to represent himself without full knowledge, that is a structural error. So the type of remedy that you're describing, it doesn't take into account the fact that the structural error has occurred and the entire trial and everything that happened is essentially invalid. And that's what the court said in Scott. Essentially, once the habitual notice is filed, the prior waiver is no longer valid. The prior waiver doesn't exist anymore. And that's what this court said. And essentially, the inquiry is at the time of the waiver is when the knowledge has to be had. Hooks reached a similar conclusion in 2008. In that case, the state filed a habitual notice almost a year after Hooks decided to waive his right to counsel in district court. And unlike Scott, the notice was filed before trial. And in that case, there was actually a discussion on the record. In the Hooks opinion, it kind of talks about the fact that there was a discussion that habitual had been filed, and the court said, we'll discuss what this means at sentencing. But there was a discussion on the record. And on those facts, this court said that the record as a whole did not sufficiently establish a valid waiver of the right to counsel, so he also got a new trial. And in reaching this conclusion, the court distinguished 2 other cases where there were habituals, and the defendant argued that he didn't have sufficient knowledge. It was Hyman versus State and Arajakis versus State. And Hooks distinguished those 2 cases and said that the difference is that at the time of the canvas, at the time of the waiver, that's when that knowledge was imparted to the defendant. In Hyman, it was when the court was questioning the defendant using the factors of SCR 253. And the court said, the record indicates that the sentences were explained several times to Hyman at that point. In Arajakis, in 1992, the quote is, both the justice court at the preliminary hearing and the district court before the trial canvassed Arajakis and advised him about the habitual punishment that the state was seeking. So the takeaways from these 2 cases, which haven't been overruled, which are mandatory law in this jurisdiction, when a defendant waives the right to counsel, he needs to know whether the state intends to punish him as a habitual offender at the time of the decision. Okay. And if a defendant has already waived his right to counsel before the state files the habitual notice, then the prior waiver isn't valid. And since our courts indulge every reasonable presumption against waiver, so essentially what should happen in a case such as this. If a habitual notice is filed, the defendant, the court needs to say, hey, defendant, a habitual notice has been filed. This means that you face life in prison. Do you still want to defend? Do you still want to represent yourself, or would you like counsel? That choice needs to be given to the defendant on the record, and he needs to verbally say what he intends to do.
And Mr. Westbrook, other than I want to go to the initial canvas.
Correct.
Other than the fact that subsequently he was made to be eligible for habitual status, are there any infirmities that you can point to with that first canvas?
Sure. There actually is one. The court gave incorrect information. This is at the District Court Feretta canvas on September 27th, 2016. It's in the record in Volume 4 at 712-47. The court actually told Mr. Banks that he was facing the battery with a deadly weapon with substantial bodily harm was a 3-30. It should have been a B2-15, which, as you explained in Rodriguez versus State, use of a deadly weapon is an element of the battery with a deadly weapon statute, so you can't apply a second enhancement on
top of that. So the court told him he was looking at more than he actually was.
Yes.
So that's not really the kind of
problem
with this.
Right, but it was an incorrect.
Okay. Any other infirmities with the initial canvas that...
I didn't believe that there was a problem with the initial canvas. Really, what this case comes down to is the Hooks and Scott error, where that initial canvas ends up being invalidated because that at the time that decision was made, the waiver wasn't voluntary, wasn't knowing.
Because we're not expecting at the time the initial canvas is made that the court has to mine the record for every possible way in which counsel could enhance the sentence, either at the time of sentencing by habitual or charge additional charges. They take the case as it is. But your position is, or is the rule that you're asking us to make, if there's a change that dramatically affects the severity or impact of the crime, then they should be re-canvassed.
Not necessarily re-canvassed, and I'm not asking the court to actually make any new law here. It's basically,
but that's what we do. It would be
telling courts and making it very clear that once that habitual notice is filed, and the court gets a copy of the habitual notice, the court's going to know when the habitual is there. And there were actually, in this case, there were three court appearances between the time of the habitual notice getting filed and trial. And during none of those hearings was anything discussed about the effect of habitual or any question made to Mr. Banks, do you intend to continue representing yourself? That didn't happen. Which is interesting because in this case, the same judge had been reversed on this very same issue in January of 2017 in Hudson versus Nevada, which is an unpublished Court of Appeals decision that Justice Silver presided on. So the court should have been aware, given you know how Hooks and Scott have been interpreted over the years, that there needed to be something on the record to allow him to basically make that decision so we can all be comfortable that it was a knowing and intelligent waiver. So unless the court has any other questions on that issue, I'd like to move along to the jury instruction issue. As we know, an accurate instruction on the basic elements of the offense charged is essential, and the failure to so instruct constitutes reversible error. In this case, the court abused its discretion in settling jury instructions, and there were seven major jury instruction errors, many of which affected the essential elements of the crimes charged. First error, the court violated Keyes versus State by instructing the jury on implied malice in an attempt murder case, and then by refusing to give a complete definition of express malice pursuant to statute. Second, the court violated Crawford versus State by refusing to give Mr. Banks proposed inverse elements instructions, which would have reminded jurors that they needed to find express malice and specific intent before convicting of attempt murder. The court also failed to give a mandatory instruction on the lesser included offense of misdemeanor battery. The court gave an improper instruction on the use of a deadly weapon, telling the jury that there need not be conduct which actually produces harm in a battery case where the weapon was a tape measure, which was not inherently dangerous, and the battery was required to involve physical use of the tape measure. The court refused Mr. Banks' alternative use of a deadly weapon instruction from Buschauer versus State, that the weapon needed to be used in conscious furtherance of a criminal objective. The court even gave improper transition instructions that appeared to require unanimity instead of using the mandatory language that this court has required in Green versus State. They should have been told that if you're unable to agree to the greater charge, you may then proceed to the lesser charge. And then finally, there was an incomplete instruction on the use of prior convictions. The court refused to tell the jury that the felony could not be, his prior felonies couldn't be used as substantive proof of his guilt in violation of Harris versus State. And when you add all of those instructional errors up together, you have a fundamentally unfair trial. We can't be, you know, we can't be comfortable given the facts of this case that the result would stand. I can go into more detail on the combined Keys and Crawford error on the attempt murder count, because I think that's probably the biggest error. To convict the defendant of attempt murder, the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant acted with the specific intent to kill or with express malice. Mr. Banks requested that the jury be given an instruction defining express malice. And in response, the state offered a general malice aforethought instruction, which was instruction 12 in the record at volume 3, 597. It contained combined concepts of express and implied malice. And that instruction told jurors, quote, malice aforethought means the intentional doing of a wrongful act without legal cause or excuse, or what the law considers adequate provocation. The instruction further told jurors that malice, quote, may arise from any unjustifiable or unlawful motive or purpose to injure another, proceeding from a heart fatally bent on mischief or with reckless disregard of consequences and social duty. Mr. Banks objected to that instruction because it referenced implied malice. And if you look at the definition of implied malice, NRS 200.020, Part 2, Mr. Banks was correct. The definition is, malice shall be implied when no considerable provocation appears or when all the circumstances of the killing show an abandoned and malignant heart. That's what the jury was essentially instructed. They were given an implied malice instruction in an attempt murder case which requires specific intent. But the court overruled Mr. Banks' objection and refused to provide a separate instruction defining express malice, which was reversible error under Keyes. Keyes, the court said, that an instruction on implied malice is necessarily misleading in an attempt murder case. You can't tell the jury that a malice involves a reckless disregard of social consequences or consequences in social duty without inviting the jury to convict based on something less than express malice. So I see my time's up and I will wait until...
All right, Ms. Whisper. Mr. Schwartz, how are you today?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Hey, please, the court, Your Honor, it's Brian Schwartz for the state. I guess the respondent in this matter. If I could jump right into the Feretta issue, I think that's really the main issue in this case I'd like to discuss. Frankly, a lot of the case law that's cited, the court needs to look at the record as a whole. It's pretty clear that it's not just the Feretta canvas at that time. The court has consistently said, look at the record as a whole, look at everything. And that's the best way to see the standard, right, if he knowingly and voluntarily waived his right to counsel. And so, specifically, there's no mechanical canvas, right? We don't have to specifically ask the same questions. The judge doesn't have to specifically go in a certain order. But altogether, looking at this case, you can tell that Mr. Banks was actually informed of his habitual criminal status. It is tough. I mean, obviously, looking back, it would have been great if the court had just said, look, Mr. Banks, large, here are the options. Small, here are the options. That would have been a lot easier for this court to look at to see if he really knew. And I guess just jumping right into my argument on habitual, directing your attention to the first day of trial, that's, I think, the best place to see the habitual issue. I mean, he really specifically says it's going to be 937, 938 of the record, but he specifically, in discussing the peremptories, he says, Your Honor, I'm looking at the possibility of life without it. Your Honor, large habitual. Your Honor, again, I'm facing life without. And so, is that the same as specifically going through all the prongs? Of course not. But you can see here that on the day of trial, before trial even started, before the jury comes in, he knew specifically the maximum sentence that he was looking for.
So you're saying the burden should have been on him to revisit the issue with the court if he was uncomfortable going forward, as opposed to the court just reaching out and saying, hey, the playing field's changed significantly since I last canvassed you. Do you want to proceed? Is that
I think the best practice is certainly for the court to reach out. Mm-hmm. I think it certainly is. That would make it a lot clearer and a lot easier for your honors to review it. But I think when you look at this, he never once wavered on his decision to represent himself. Never once. Every canvas he did, he was very, yes, Your Honor, I understand I'm doing this. He never had any questions about, well, I'm not sure. Well, now that I know I'm facing life without, that's a much different sentence than 2 to 20 or 3 to 30 or 2 to 15. And so I'm not saying that it should be his burden, but when you look at the record as a whole, I think you can infer that he was aware, he was intelligently aware of the maximum sentence and the whole large eventual.
I get your argument, Mr. Schwartz, and certainly he, as you say, the record demonstrates that he was aware of that sentence. I'm not sure the record demonstrates, though, what you just articulated, and that is that knowing that he's facing this, there's a difference between knowing that he faces this charge after having committed to representing himself, right, but knowing that before he commits to representing himself. I don't think there's anything in the record that demonstrates that he was aware of this before he committed to representing himself. Would you agree with that?
I would.
Okay, so given his statements on the record, how do we as a panel address Scott and cases that counsel has argued, from her point of view, compel a weak canvas if this is filed after an initial Feretta canvas, and in the absence of doing so, that it's structural error? I mean, if we read those cases to require that, how do we overcome that in the face of this record?
I guess
it seems to be a kind of a mechanical requirement, and that would require potentially, well, first of all, I'm interested in your view of, is counsel reading those cases correctly? Do you share her view about what they say?
So I disagree to the extent that Scott or Hooks specifically say at the time of the Feretta, he must be aware. I don't think that's what they say. I tried to look back through to see if that's specifically what it said. And frankly, it wouldn't make sense in reading that holding with the holding of, like, Graves, for example. Because in Graves, they talk about looking at the record as a whole. They're not saying, look, let's look at the Feretta canvas. At that point, did he knowingly and voluntarily claim his right to counsel? That's not the holding in that case. And I understand Graves is a few years earlier, but certainly when you read them together, I think Scott, I mean, the issue more on Scott is similar to this one, that he was never informed of the habitual. There is no evidence in the record that he was aware that he could get life without. And so...
So is the state asking us to revisit the holding in Scott that in cases in which the defendant otherwise demonstrates knowledge of the exposure that the defendant has, even if it's post-canvas, that is sufficient?
I do think that whether you revisit the holding or not, I think you can kind of read it similarly with Scott because the facts are distinguishable. There's nothing in Scott that's similar to here. And again, I don't think reading Scott necessarily means that at the time of the canvas, everything must be covered. I think it's more of a looking at Scott with looking at Graves as a record, kind of totality of the circumstances analysis.
Well, I think constitutionally, Feretta requires, at a minimum, that the defendant be aware of their maximum exposure to liability in the case.
And that's not exactly what Graves says, right? Because in Graves, they don't even advise him on the record.
Well, now I'm talking about the Feretta case.
Oh, understood, Your Honor. And I think, and I guess to the extent that you wanted to revisit Scott to allow for a situation such as this, that might be appropriate. I think the reason I keep
certainly, I'm not sure we want to invite trial judges to make a canvas and then have the, in this, have a habitual criminal notice filed or some other circumstance change where the defendant's exposure is substantially greater and then move on.
Agreed. And I think that's, I don't think that this case should be the rule, right? I don't think what happened in this case should be the rule, the template to follow. I think certainly looking at the way that the cases have come down, the more information you can give a pro se defendant, the better, right? To make sure, just double check, look, Mr. Banks, we just filed this, it changes the entire game, you're looking now at life without. We should have, and I agree with that, and I think that looking though, and I guess I keep harping on this looking at the record as a whole argument because that's what I was relying on with Graves, and I think that if you are going to use that kind of totality circumstance in reviewing what the district court judge is actually seeing from a defendant in court, seeing his demeanor, seeing how he's answering her questions when she's asking him, are you sure that you want to do this? I mean, I actually had her, and it was, again, before the habitual file, I asked her, can we just make sure he really wants to represent himself? Because we were having issues with getting an expert. He was getting frustrated because no one was giving him the appropriate time at the jail. And so it didn't feel like in this situation we were kind of ignoring the fact that he was pro se. And it felt like the judge and even the district attorney's office, the standby counsel, we were taking lots of steps to try to help him out along the way. And so I could see if it looked like by looking at the record as a whole that he was almost bamboozled, kind of a weird idea, but all of a sudden he gets to sentencing and now he's hit with this habitual that he didn't know about. I could see that being an issue, but looking at the record again as a whole, I mean, he really, and he knew the maximum, right? I think that's kind of significant too. Because if he knew he was facing life without and still didn't want standby counsel, I mean, he barely let standby counsel sit at the table. At first, he wanted her to be in the back of the room. But it seemed like, you know, once he got to trial, he understood some of the issues that come with trial. And I think looking at everything is important in this case because he, similar to if it was Wayne or Graves, but the court was persuaded by the fact that the defendant had some legal experience previously. He'd represented himself before. The defendant, while he didn't represent himself at a jury trial, he represented himself in an extradition hearing coming from Arizona. He concurrently to this case, and this was not part of the record, but just since I was dealing with it, I knew about it. He was representing himself in another case that was kind of trailing behind this case. It was a failure to register case. So just kind of some factors that are different than a lot of the things that you see in Hooks and the other cases that we've discussed, but essentially showing that he knows the law a little bit more than a normal person. He said he studied the law for 8 years, or he had studied criminal law for 8 years and had been familiar with some of the issues, I guess. And it kind of shows, right? Like, he's facing a battery and an attempt murder charge where he uses a tape measure. And he picks pretty good defenses. I mean, he's not going to be able to say it wasn't him. Why? Everyone there knows him. Plus, he's 6'10 and has long black dreads. I mean, that's not something that is going to be easy to say, oh, I'm mistaken identity. He goes with self-defense, which makes sense. He attacks the deadly weapon because it's a tape measure. Makes sense. And he tries to attack the substantial bodily harm with the expert that he hired. And so, I mean, it just looking at everything, it really shows kind of a different situation. And similar, I guess dissimilar from the Court of Appeal holdings that defense counsel mentioned, I mean, there's nothing in there, at least in the holdings that I reviewed, that indicated that kind of extensive knowledge, that he even had an idea of habitual. I could see that if this case was in a situation where he had absolutely no idea, or at least the record didn't show it, I could understand that it would maybe not even be necessary for oral argument. It would be just consistent with the hearings and reversal. I think.
How do you distinguish Keyes and Ramos as far as the attempt murder charge?
Yes, Your Honor. Give me a brief indulgence. The issue, at least with Keyes, Your Honor, the issue was that the court refused to instruct the jury that to be convicted of attempt murder, you must specifically intend to kill. And they didn't give that instruction. Here, that's the attempt murder instruction that we have here. I think certainly I understand the point that's being made about the malice instruction when the reason I wanted the malice instruction is because if you see an attempt murder instruction that says, you know, specific acts are done with express malice, express with the deliberate intent to unlawfully kill, if I'm a juror, I'm not sure what malice means there. So the malice instruction, I think, was necessary to explain that instruction. There's nowhere that, the way that I interpret what we didn't instruct them on implied malice. It's not like you can find express malice if you find implied malice. I mean, it's pretty clear that you still need, regardless, even if you kind of, if you read them together, you still need the intent to kill. There's nowhere in there that says you can't find an attempt murder without the intent to kill. I think that's the distinction here. One thing I did want to address, if Your Honors don't mind me going back to the Feretta issue, because Justice Stiglitz brought it up, I think it's an interesting point that I had thought about myself as far as a resentencing issue. I know it's been addressed, at least in the Court of Appeals cases, and it didn't seem like it was persuasive at that time, but I do think that if you look at the Feretta canvas and you strike everything about prevention and you just kind of move forward from there, it seems to me that's valid Feretta, advised of all the appropriate things, and then if he's sentenced on a non-habitual charge, then everything about the habitual kind of goes away because nothing changes at trial with habitual. Right? There's no extra preempts, as we see from the record. There's not a penalty phase or anything weird that might come with the habitual notice. It's strictly a sentencing issue. I certainly understand it's not a harmless error analysis. We can't apply that to an invalid Feretta, but it's not invalid if you take out the notice, right? It becomes valid. It's sort of curing. It becomes, you cure, if you did find that it was an invalid Feretta, you cure it by striking the habitual, and everything else would remain the same except for resentencing it. I do think that would be a potential option here if you were uncomfortable with just affirming it based on my prior arguments. I think another potential thing that I also considered was he had standby counsel. There's not a lot of discussion in some of the cases about what standby counsel really does. I mean, I know because I've discussed with standby counsel some offers that involved habitual. Right? There was a stiff habitual offer right up to trial. So I know that she went over with him the offers because she came back and we discussed it. And so I certainly could see a situation where a limited remand and evidentiary hearing to see if she had advised him of small, of large. If he had ever told her once, you know what, I don't want to represent myself because...
Yeah, Mr. George, I just want to, you're running out of time, so yes. I want to just shift gears or go back really quickly. Do you think the court is fulfilling the mandate of Crawford? Not whether it should be reversed for not giving it or not, but in real time, is the court giving the inverse instructions or reformulating them, you know, such that the spirit of Crawford was implemented in this case?
I see my time's up. May I answer your question?
That's up to the chief.
Yes, of course. Yes. That's a good question, Justice Stiglitz. I mean, because I think if you recall from the record, I actually was in agreement to give the inverse instruction. I think the main issue here is whether it was substantially covered. I mean, I know that's kind of a...
Substantially covered, right, or there won't be an inverse. Like, you have to have an instruction to have an inverse.
It's that's a little bit of a cop-out answer, I agree. I mean, I don't think that necessarily... Are we upholding Crawford to the extent that we're giving it every time? No. Are we upholding Crawford to the extent that it is substantially covered? Yes. I guess that would be my kind of distinction to that question.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Westbrook.
I want to focus mainly on Feretta. Counsel has suggested that, again, we, you know, possibly go back and just resentence him. But the problem with that is that you can't cure a structural error after the fact. If it's a structural error, it's a structural error, and the entire trial needs to be done over. Counsel also discusses the fact that Banks was apparently informed because he mentioned on the first day of trial, after trial had begun, that he knew that he faced a life sentence. We need to remember that was in the context of a discussion of peremptory challenges. He had standby counsel, but standby counsel is not really supposed to be advising, you know, necessarily. That's not his attorney. She doesn't have an obligation to inform him about everything that's going on in the case. It's only she's there as a resource to him. So, you know, to the extent there may have been discussions that aren't in the record that the state has referenced in this oral argument, I don't think the court can be considering what may have been said outside between counsel, standby counsel, and Mr. Banks. But basically, you know, the issue is he may have wanted to represent himself, certainly, and it was clear he wanted to represent himself. But it can't just be voluntary. It has to be knowing and intelligent. And saying on the first day of trial that you're aware that you face life in the context of trying to get some additional peremptories, that's not the same thing as saying, I'm aware that I face life in prison and I still want to represent myself. Because there's no indication that he knew that the Scott case existed or the Hooks case existed, that there would need to be, you know, some sort of re-upping. And you know, if he's not aware of that, then his statements on the record are essentially meaningless in terms of this court's interpretation of the record as a whole, consideration of the record as a whole. We also have to remember the fact that at his initial Feretta canvas, the district court told him, once you decide on self-representation, you know you can't change your mind in the middle of proceedings and request an attorney. That was in the record at volume 4, page 736. At 737, the court reiterated, once you go down this road, you're committed. The court repeated that between 737 and 738, and the court's not going to allow you to change your mind midstream. If the court, you know, if there's really nothing, even if you know that on the first day of trial he was aware, that's insufficient under this court's standard for waiver. It's just not going to be enough when we indulge every reasonable presumption against waiver. In addition, the court asked, you know, whether there should be a burden on the pro per defendant or whether, you know, it should be a burden on the court. And in the case of a pro per defendant, clearly, you know, they're at a disadvantage. So the court needs to adhere to the existing precedent in Scott and in Hooks and give the pro per defendant an opportunity to state on the record whether they intend to continue representing themselves. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thanks, Ms. Westbrook and Mr.